Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Going to do this. I haven't got the thing written down.
We haven't got the script.
Can you just jazz?
Right. I'll try and remember it.
What did we say?
Okay. 3, 4. Hello and welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Jason Hazley. Oh, hang on. Should have written this down. And I'm Joel Morris.
That's it. And as usual, we're joined by someone, something, something, comedy, something. Something, yep. Talk about something funny that they love.
Yep.
I'm Jason Hazley.
Goodbye.
Sorry, no.
By
taking it apart.
By taking it apart, maybe we'll quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished.
Both approaches are valid.
Working. That's it.
Oh, that's great.
Maybe we'll learn something.
Brilliant. I like
welcome
doing it live.
To Rule 3.
Hello. We're joined this week for
our
this
special
shambles.
Guest.
I can't make it, guys. The bus is late.
Our special guest this week is the marvellous Andy Stanton. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Jason. Hello, Joel.
I know, but I sort of feel that there's a symbolic...
I thought you guys were doing quite well.
No.
There's a symbolic shambles, actually, which we should be embracing for this.
It feels there, a bit... Really? We should be a bit loose, shouldn't we? Yeah. I mean, I think the first loose thing was to forget to bring the piece of paper with the intro written on it. That's a good start.
I don't think anyone noticed.
No, it was quite slickly done, wasn't it? Seamless, absolutely. I think we pros might notice, but Joe Public at home...
Yeah, the layperson wouldn't have a clue.
No, not a clue.
See anything gone wrong. Yes. So, Andy, you're preparing for a stage thing at the moment, aren't you? Because obviously you do books,
yeah,
and you are now doing what you know, and books are on stage.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
Are those?
Well, the National Theatre come to me, innit? And they go, would you like to turn one of your Mr. Gum books into a play? And I said, I've always thought it should be a musical. So that was their first mistake,
really?
And that was my first mistake. And from there on, some mistakes have snowballed, and it's actually coming out at the end of July, and then all of August, and it's the ride of my life.
Wow.
Yes.
Is it a bit frightening?
Yeah.
is it frightening because doing theatre and things is just frightening, or is it frightening because you're used to being on your own and this is a big collaboration and there's lots of other people?
It's frightening because it's a big endeavour and you don't know what's going to happen till it's actually up on legs on the night. Or standing up, or I thought I was quite good at the theatre jargon, but no. I use the word declared a lot now. I go, well, should we just make that declared then? That's what you have to say in theatre.
What's that? What's...
Well, it's like sort of saying, we haven't really got the money to do this prop, so let's sort of make a virtue of it. Let's just make it declared that the guy is wheeling it off rather than we're flying it off with pyrotechnics or something.
Don't hide your limitations, like the coconuts in Holy Grail. Make a joke of it.
Yeah, broadly, but you wouldn't understand not being
not
in theatre.
No,
and then the other thing is, everything's offers. I mean, that's an offer. So I'm enjoying
what
that.
What have they done to you?
What have I done to them? It's a horrible mess. And
There's offers in theatre, because I know there's offers in improv.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Is it the same sort of thing?
Yeah, the actors will look at the part of the script and they'll sort of, you know, and to me it's just the words what I've written. Mm. But then the director will say, actually, think about that. That's quite a big offer. And the line is something like, you know, my leg hurts. And I'm like, how's that an offer? But then I go, oh, yeah, maybe it is. It's an offer that somebody has to respond to. Everything is an offer in theatre. And they're brilliant.
So art is something that calls for a reaction, rather.
I think so, yeah.
Don't just read the words out.
Again, it's hard to explain to those not in the game.
I feel I've got so much to learn. I mean, I thought I was good with theatre jargon because I knew the word tabs and iron and things like that, but no.
I don't think I know tabs. I don't think we do tabs at National.
Which are you in the big room? Are you in the Olivier?
No, we're in the Dorfman, thanks for asking.
Oh, right, okay.
I believe that's even bigger. No, the other end of it is that, yeah, when you write a book, it's quite solitary, and it's very solitary. It's horrible. Every day is like another slice of an endless grey rainbow, and yay, work at home, kids, it's fun. But in theatre, it's suddenly really collaborative, and that's hard to give my baby up, something that I've lived with for 15 years, that series of books, to a bunch of people. And that's been my biggest challenge, is just knowing when not to step in and go, oh, excuse me, actually, I think you'll find that there's an interior rule that only exists in my head that probably isn't actually relevant to your process now. I'll just be quiet. And I'm sort of learning more and more of that. I feel like I've learnt about 5 years of theatre in 6 months.
Wow.
Which is much better than the other way around. That would be inefficient, wouldn't it?
Wow. To what extent is the script actually... Well, it's a book, isn't it, in a musical? To what extent is the book finished by the time it goes into rehearsal? Is there an awful lot more work to be done on it?
Yes. Especially if I'm the playwright. Sondheim, probably less so. There's loads of things that change. The first thing is I'm adapting my book, and I find that lots of things that work on the page just don't work on a stage, and you have to make them more dynamic, you have to make them more dramatic, you have to give bigger offers, and you have to declare certain things. But then you find the stuff that looked good in the script, you find problems that you didn't know were going to come up. I mean, a very broad thing is that this was written when in my head, we had 50 people, and we don't. We have 6 actors and 4 musicians. So how do we get the bear off and get them changed into Captain Brazil in the space of one? There's no lines in between. Let's write some more lines. But there's many, many sort of variants on that. Or, yeah, in the last couple of weeks, and we're 2 weeks from going up on stage, in the last couple of weeks, I must have rewritten 3 or 4 big scenes quite substantially, and there'll be a few more.
Wow.
But it's very normal, apparently.
Yeah,
It's all problem-solving. I suppose all creativity is just problem-solving anyway.
I love editing. That's my favourite part of writing. So this is just like editing in 12 dimensions, in space, in a straitjacket.
On fire.
Made of your internal fears. Yeah. On fire. Doing creative stuff is... I'm fascinated by my own minutiae. I happen to know that at least one of you two is Joel. The minutiae of the work and sort of how you get there. Only you have that sort of micro topography of understanding. And no one else can understand it. And even you can't see everything that you did to get in your process. And I find that endlessly fascinating. Or when you're performing live, you know, I go and talk at book festivals and stuff. Over the years, I've honed and continue to hone my sort of material as I talk to kids and their parents, and there's loads of improvisation. But, you know, only you know that you used to do that bit really slowly 100 times, and on the 101st time, you just accidentally did it fast, and then you can't follow it.
It sort of all mulches down. I always find that when you're doing any project or writing anything or making anything, that every time you make a good decision, you immediately forget you made that decision, and that just goes into the bank of that's how that's done. And you sort of, whenever you're looking at a plot you've done or a page of jokes you've done, it becomes compost. It all mulches down. And all the thousands of decisions you made to get to the point where you went, it's about a cat.
Yeah.
You go, well, it's always been about a cat. It took weeks.
Oh, yeah.
And they then become invisible. And you start fetishizing the tiny decisions you're making on top of the tiny decisions. And you're only thinking about the very, very top layer. And you forget the work that was put into getting to the stage where you could decide what colour the cat was.
But also it makes it a bit quicker, and I think a bit quicker for next time, that you won't spend so long.
Yeah.
Before you get to the cat, maybe. It's not that efficient, but like you sort of go, you have some sort of internal thing where you go, I've kind of built the app in Yeah. I built the app to do that a bit faster next time, or to get to that bit. It's hard to talk about.
The software's more efficient.
You've given yourself a firmware upgrade.
So you can work a bit faster, yeah.
What do you do when you work at home? You give yourself a firmware upgrade.
And then when you've done that, you go and wash your hands.
And that brings us nicely on to filth.
You have brought something absolutely filthy in. You mentioned this to me in passing, and you said this was the most inspirational book. This was the thing that made you want to write.
Yeah.
And I love the idea that it's this. Do tell the boys and girls what you have brought in.
I wish it weren't. It's Nicholas Nickleby. No, it's Bachelor Boys, the Young Ones book, which was the comedy book brought out to tie in with the Young Ones television series in the early 80s.
Once in every lifetime comes a love like this. Oh, I need you.
This up online to see if there's anything about this, and there is absolutely nothing. No one has written about this book. No one's
really.
The only person who's written about it, and I couldn't get in because it was behind a paywall. Richard Curtis reviewed this book for the Literary Review, and he reviewed it next to Anna Karenina as a two for one review. And I think that's exactly where we should be looking at this. Is they are both great works of literature that have influenced many people.
Yes, I think that's. I haven't read Anna Karenina. I tried. Couldn't be bothered.
See, now that's the difference. I would say that's the difference of these books. Any of these books, whatever you grew up with, whatever your one of these was, you read and overread, that it will have had a deeper impact on you than most novels you've ever read, which you might have read once. You will have read this again and again.
Well, I'm a big novel reader, and everything goes in, and you use it. It goes into that mulch that you were talking about. Bachelor Boys is the book that, it's the template from which I sprouted my fur. It gave me lots of shapes of jokes and lots of shapes of routines. And it's what it gave me more than anything is mucking about with form.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I do in Mr. Gum. This is the book that just showed me take it, run with it, break it some more.
There's no rules.
No.
Yeah.
But know the rules.
Yes.
Yeah. And squash them into smithereens.
Honestly, whenever anything explodes in this house, it's always blame Vivian.
Because it looks like it's a chaotic, like a lot of these books, it's a chaotic looking book. But the first thing I noticed when I opened it up is who designed it. It's designed by Neville Brody, who's the guy who designed the face. He was like the most influential typographer of the time. They got the best guy in the business who designed like high-end magazines to do this. So the perfect example of someone who knows how to do it, who's then going to smash it all up.
That's it. I mean, it's dressing up the gags so that when you come to a page, you know, oh, this is sort of a takeoff of magazine agony aunt letters there's a bit called Craft Corner, and you just know where you are. And the typography doesn't insist on itself, but it just beds each piece so that a big disparate load of everything holds together. And then you just go, fine, I don't need to know why there's a piece called Craft Corner in this. I don't need to know why Neil's suddenly writing a cookery book in this. It's just, I know it's there because the typography just goes, cookery book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The great thing about these books is they sort of contain multitudes. They've got, they're a grab bag. They're supposed to be like a big chocolate box.
Yeah, and also, looking at it now, many years later, I'm also a bit hipper to the... Yeah, they're trying to fill pages as well.
Yeah.
And they're kind of splitting the difference. They want it to be a big grab bag of stuff and ideas, but occasionally, I can see Jason just flicking through it now, there's an entire page which is Neil dressed as a hitchhiker, and it's funny, but it's also another page done, isn't it? And, you know, let's get it out. I can see it with a more cynical eye. The other thing I see, having... been an author for 13 years now is lots of typos that hurt me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it's fine because there is so much material in there, but I would never let them get in.
Yeah.
Even when you say you'll never let them get in, five still get into any given project. No, three. But really, there's hundreds in Bachelor Boys.
But it's got a feeling of, even the typos and things, it's got a feeling of energy and pace.
Absolutely.
And the thing that's in common with all these books, if you've ever been commissioned to write one of these, and Jason and I have done lots of these sort of Christmas tie-in books that they're trying to do, and they're doing them for one reason only, which is that the Monty Python books in the early 70s sold by the bucket load.
Uh-huh.
And it meant that every publisher said, whatever the big television show is this year or the big craze is, we want a Loads of Money book, or we want a Mary Whitehouse book, because it was a guarantee where you wrote it quite quickly on quite a quick deadline, just filled the thing up. And they are basically rag mags, is what they basically are. They're basically the same thing as they are if you ever ran a a college or a school.
Yeah, they're zines. They're giant zines.
And what you do is you fill them up. And the joy of this one, of course, is unlike the Python books, which are very, very high-end, very colourful with printing jokes, this is black and white, a bit punky, simple. It's scrappy, and all it's got in it is energy and pace.
Great gags.
Yeah, yeah.
And a bit of design. But yeah, it looks like it's of its time. We'll talk about that photo in a minute. Thank you very much.
Jason's trying to distract everyone by showing people pictures of Rick in the bath.
Rick having a crafty tug in the bath. And
that was the rudest thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
Was that for everybody?
I think you did it on purpose because you know I've got a runny bottom.
That's the other thing about this book. I mean, I got it when I was about 10. And I was really into the young ones when I was about 8. And I don't really know why my parents let me, but you know, I think it's fairly benign, but you know, they weren't really, it sneaked under the radar. We had a fancy dress competition at school when I was about 8 or 9, and everyone went as Peter Pan or some Disney princess, and I went as Vivian. And I like borrowed a cut off denim jacket from my cool older cousin, and I made dog collars out of black cardboard and stuck foil on to make the spikes. Got like 3 cans of orange spray from the local fun shop, Funtasia. True story. Yeah, I lived in a cartoon because a joke shop opened up at the end of our street when I was like 7 called Funtasia. And it, really? Anyway, and I was walking round this parade in the primary school assembly hall, and I was flicking the V's.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what it meant. And looking back on it now, I can almost see the teacher's thought process, which is he doesn't know what it means. Better to just not tell him and just let him get on with it. No one will notice.
If you tell him, it'll only get worse.
Exactly. And so that I was obsessed with that. And then this book came out and I was about 10. And this is, to me, you know, I haven't got kids, but I'm not a fan of swearing in front of kids as a rule. Certainly not in my career. And I'm not a fan of... I wouldn't be a fan of, like, letting them watch stuff that I think is, you know, too violent or too sexy or whatever.
Yeah.
But books and the written word and the communion that goes on between a reader and an author is a really different thing. And I'm a big fan of kids finding the stuff they want to read and learning, pushing the envelope a bit more through the written word. And that's what you're allowed to do in books. This book also taught me that you can be sort of ruder or more daring in books than you can be in other formats. Like on TV, you couldn't get away with a lot of the gags that are in here because they're much sexier, they're ruder.
It's like having headphones on or something.
Even when you're doing knob gags, as half of Bachelor Boys, the Young Ones book does, there's a kind of banner of okayness that's waved above it all because it's literature at some at some level. It is. The written word is a beautiful thing, and it's a different beautiful thing from the spoken word on TV or film. There are different rules and there's a different nobility to it, even when it's not
actually
gags.
The same was true of the Python books, which were much, much ruder than the TV. The Goodies books are way ruder than the TV series. It must be the same rules that you can do this.
Books are more subversive, ultimately, than TV and film because they're private and things can get hidden in them. Ideas can get communicated more telepathically to the reader, and you have a dialogue. That's the communion. That's what I love about books. So this book, there's stuff in here that, like, if I had like a 10-year-old, I wouldn't want them to read it, but in another way I'd totally want them to read whatever they found, really.
Yes.
Because it's a much more thoughtful processing of what they... And what's interesting to me is that I was looking through this prior to coming here to talk about it, and in my head it was much swearier than it actually is.
Yeah.
So even though, you know, there are things that are inappropriate for a 10-year-old, on one level, it's not full of fucks and things.
No, not at all.
It would be now, probably.
But they never were they? The Young Ones as characters were always... All their sort of profanities, for want of a better word, were all quite childish.
They were childish.
There was a lot of bum, wasn't there?
This one gets much... It goes further. You have shit and wanker and things in this. Well, they had bastard in the show. But, I mean, there's a whole bit called Let's Swear right at the top of this book. And some of the examples they give are poo hole, gas leak pants, toilet trousers, farty breath. And then the last one is stupid, ugly, bastard face, fascist. So it's not actually... in my head... I was like, oh, I learnt such profanities from this book, but I didn't.
Yeah,
no.
It's got the lovely tone of voice that Rick's character's got, which is a rebel, but a rebel who likes Cliff Richard. The music references in The Young Ones are really interesting in that it's all about Santana and Paul McCartney and Cliff Richard. Even though they had Motorhead and, like, hipper bands on the show, the characters aren't into those bands. The characters are into Steve Hillage and things from the 70s. It's a really clever thing of they're not being real rebels. Rick is a classic example of an only child and a spoiled kid. They're all not quite as cool as they think they are. Mike says he's a cool person, which is the first sign of someone who isn't a cool person. They're not cool or edgy. They are actually just little kids. They're lost.
There's a nice how cool are you thing, isn't there, about who would you most like to assassinate? Thatcher, Hitler or Orville?
Yeah, I mean, because Ben Elton is a big part of the young ones, half of the words in this book are Thatcher. The other half are Nob.
That Thatcher joke does not stop being funny. That almost the end of every sentence is Thatcher.
Yeah.
But again, it's almost like, again, they're aware of going, this is what you think an alternative comedian at a nightclub would be like.
Thatcher's bloody Britain!
And they're aware that they're not really being alternative comedians, they're being a piss take. There's a level of irony in it that I don't think I got the joke at the time, and I still don't 100% get it, but it's delightful.
That's another important thing about learning from fiction. This is fiction. You reverse engineer the world from fiction. I spent my life doing this. I still, to this day, I read probably about 5% factual books and 95% fiction, and you know, that's a big up for me. It used to be 99.1, you know. And so what it means is that I'm understanding the world through other people's thought processes and filterings and opinions, and then I'll reverse engineer and know what I think about reality.
Oh, wow! Oh, heavy, heavy, heavy!
Oh. For instance, do you know the American comic strip Bloom County? There's a bit in it where Opus the penguin, in one of the storylines, suffers from an amnesia, and he doesn't know who he is, and he goes, who am I? Do I prefer Stephen King or Saul Bellow? And I knew who Stephen King was, but in my head at the time it was like, oh, Saul Bellow must be another horror writer, but more sophisticated. Right. But then later on you find out Saul Bellow wasn't a horror writer. He was a literary giant. And I go, oh, yeah, I didn't get that. But you always reverse engineering in it. And if you don't read enough fact and you only read fiction, you'll get a hell of a lot of things wrong in the right way and you'll turn into a kooky character.
But you're kind of using... It's an exercise for your brain to say, OK, I need to be able to triangulate information.
Information.
Out of data. And there's a great thing about The Young Ones was huge in America, which I hadn't realised why, and it was MTV showed it. It was the only non-music thing that they bought up. They bought up loads of it and showed it because it had bands in it. That's why Adrian Edmondson's in Star Wars and things, and why a lot of Americans love it. But they were triangulating British culture from this. And if you go online, there's all these debates going, who is Cliff Richard? What? And they're trying to work out who these people are.
Yeah. Cliff Richard's got no footprint in the States.
No, that's what we're going, he's a kind of Pat Boone.
He sounds like a vampire, though. Richard's got no... He leaves no footprints in the States. Like, very niche sort of mythical being.
This thing, which has got all these specific cultural references in it, was taken on board by people because it was so energetic and young and new wavy and punky. That they went, I want this, and they grabbed it, and they grabbed all the stuff that came with it as well, all the cultural baggage as well, and they're all discussing, like they did with Python and things, who are these people that they're talking about? Not realising that there's a level of straight, that they don't exist in normal Britain. They live in a distorted, slightly unhip version of Britain.
Right, I mean, look at Northern Soul. They take, no, seriously, they take, you know, the north of England falls in love with American, you know, soul music and rhythm and blues, and they take on board this whole kind of badly Xeroxed version of what that culture is, which isn't to say they don't understand it, but it's just a different, it's a different translation and a different set of ideas that the triangulation of culture. And I got, I mean, that's, most of what I know is in between the pages of this little toilet book.
Maybe that's one of the things this is, because it did appeal to younger people, because there's a cartoon, there's a slapstick Tom and Jerry-ness to the young ones. You got into the young ones before you were their age. I mean, certainly for our generation, I was too young for it, even when it was on. So it's a little crack into student life and almost like semi-adult life and rebellious life from when you're too young to do that. But you're going to get it all wrong. Some of the information is going to be useful about how to be naughty and how to be rude and stuff. And some of it's going to be a bit distorted and weird. But it is quite a useful thing because it seems sort of harmless because of that.
It does. I still can't quite join all the dots and imagine the young ones as a student house. It doesn't quite land for me. There were it doesn't have to. It's just like it takes place... Probably because, it was long before I was a student that I got into the young ones. And by the time I was a student, the... feel of student living wasn't quite like it was in the young one, so it doesn't feel real to me at that level, right? But then again, in Seinfeld, say, I've got no idea how old any of the characters are meant to be. They're ageless to me. They look quite young, but they dress like 48-year-olds, 52-year-olds, and that's a different cultural thing.
The young ones, there are bits in this. There's a guide to sort of how to share food in a fridge that feels like a solid rag-mag, college magazine, observational thing about student life. And it stands out a mile because it's the kind of thing that's actually an observation of something that really exists. And the strange thing about the young ones is it's an incredibly bad representation of student living because it's inaccurate and it doesn't matter. But at the same time, it's got the essence of the chaos of adolescence absolutely spot on.
It's
an allegory for it rather than an accurate thing. Yeah. There's a lot of, you read a lot of criticism of comedy programmes, especially comedy programmes where they go, oh yeah, it's set in estate agents, but my mate's an estate agent. Well, they wouldn't really do that. And you go, no, a lot of comedy is allegorically correct rather than, it's not meant to be a realistic painting.
Well, the other end of that is the guy who works in the estate agents and says, they should make a show of this place because it's... And it's like, no, because without translation, that's
very boring.
It's reality TV.
Yeah, there is a version of the young ones that is an accurate depiction of studenthood that probably we wouldn't still be talking about. It would be a thing for that year. It would never have lasted.
Well, it's not a bad depiction of the kind of the sort of chaos that your head's in about that age, is it? Really?
No, but it's an abstraction and it's a...
Yes.
And the grubbiness of it... comes through, but it never, I never think of the young ones as, oh, that informed anything for me about college. The actual reality
quite,
of it,
quite.
it sits in a slightly different dimension.
What the young ones gets completely right, and what this book particularly, probably even more than the TV series, is this is the inside of Rick and Neil and Mike and Vivian's heads. They're pouring the stuff onto the page because it's been written fast. You can tell it's been written fast. You can tell it's been written by a bunch of people, and oddly, without even a photograph of the cast members by it, you can tell who's written each page. Not which of Lisa Mayer and Rick Mayall and Ben Elton's written each page, but which character's written each page. Because it's all the inside of their heads poured out almost as if they haven't got any brakes on. They just run, and it's just stream of consciousness, and they talk to themselves and correct themselves, and there's no rules. No one's gone through and edited this. It's as if there hasn't been time.
Well, there's loads of interesting things there. One is that I love it when the characters fight on the same page.
Yes.
Like, one narrative suddenly breaks off with, oh, shut up, Rick! Like, written in marker pen by Viv. Or sometimes it's not even so obvious as written in marker pen, just another voice intrudes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know that in the other world, they've grabbed the book off Neil and continued writing.
Yeah. It's got the animation and direction of the TV show, but on the page. And I don't know, it's almost magical the way, because it's got so much energy in the writing that you can feel them hitting each other.
Neil!
For a tie-in book, one of the key things for a TV show is to get some photos of the cast. Very often, when you're writing a book for it, it's done by someone. It's not, the cast aren't there, they're off doing a stage show somewhere, they're busy doing something else. This is done as a little filler project on the run-up to Christmas, where it's delivered in summer. There has to be some money in the budget to get the cast in and some props for them to dress up, because then you put them on the page and the reader then goes, oh, look, it's Mel and Griff. They wrote this book, even though they might not have done. And they've done a lot of that. They've put the cast in this. But there's not a lot of photo stories or anything. It's mainly text. There's not a lot of stuff where they're hitting each other. There's a couple, and they're beautiful, and you get the full expressions. You get Rick's face, and you get Ada Edmondson hitting him and things. But that only happens two or three times. The rest of it is all in your mind, because you've seen the show, and they've managed to get the show into prose. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. This taught me a lot about exactly what you're talking about. You can picture the scene behind the text, and you can picture what you can go, oh, when something is physically crossed out on the page, that's because the guy made a mistake, and then he's carried on after it with. And I do that in Mr. Gum. I do bits where there's a bit in Mr. Gum and the Goblins where it goes, I'm building atmosphere for a spooky bit. It goes like, and they went up Goblin Mountain. There it stood, like one of those lovely twirly curly drinking straws that you do, and it goes through there, and it's crossed out. An old witch's finger is then inserted after it, right? And that sort of thinking is from this sort of book, which is, I get to play some design games in my books, not as many as you can do in what I think of these as the essential comedy book format as a zine format or a magazine format. It's a modular thing.
That's why you've got a magazine designer doing it. Exactly, it's someone who's got that language.
Yeah.
It's not as, you know, when I'm writing a book, I'll have a bit where suddenly Mr. Gum and his horrible cronies are singing a song, la, 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 right? And then suddenly it was like, oh, I'm ever so sorry about that. Let's bring that to a halt. And then, oh, there'll be a note from the publisher, and you turn over and there is a designed up page in this thing that looks like a, you know, a novel for kids, where it sort of says, oh, good evening, everybody. So sorry about that. and we brought that song to a halt because it was disgraceful. Yours sincerely, Mr. Egmont, they're my publishers, also signed Mrs. Egmont, brackets, Mr. Egmont in a dress, right? And then it's, and now back to the story, and you go back to normal font. That is, dialing that sort of stuff in has all come from this type of book, and this book in particular.
Growing up and seeing these books, they do blow your mind as to what's possible.
Exactly.
Especially because a lot of the books you're given as a child are quite well behaved. The books that are loved by kids, the classics, the all-time classics, play with these. I was saying this to Nadia Sharoon when she came on and said that Alice in Wonderland does it. They bust, the prose goes out of control. Winnie the Pooh, he sits on the letters sometimes.
Yes.
Kids love that thing of going, oh, I know it's meant to be a book and well behaved, but sometimes the pictures bump into the text bumps into the pictures. Sometimes the words are badly behaved. There's loads of that in kids' books now. But that really went mad with these comedy tie-in books that you'd get at Christmas for, as a stocking filler, because the Pythons would do tip-ins of other books and whatever. We did it once, because the point is anything goes in these books, and we did it once in one of our family books that in the middle of it were two pages cut out of a Jamie Oliver cookbook.
Yes.
That we just tipped in and looked as if they'd been guillotined the wrong size, so bits of the recipe were missing, because like Jamie Oliver's books were made in the same factory as ours were. We thought it'd be quite funny if they had been misbound.
Yeah.
But that joke just says the edge of this book isn't the page. And the edge of this book isn't a two-dimensional black and white series of words. There's someone writing it. There's someone binding it. There's someone drawing it. There are physical people making this.
While we're on that production thing, by the way, I remember thinking when I got this book that I was slightly disappointed that it wasn't in colour, because The Young Ones as a programme was so blindingly colourful,
yeah,
and ridiculously so almost. And I understand, obviously, that it's production considerations and costs and things like that. But I do remember thinking, oh, it's in black and white. That doesn't feel like The Young One's world. That feels like it's a different precinct.
But it is fanzine-y and it is punky.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
it looks like sniffing glue.
It feels right. Then the next one that came out, really, Neil's Book of the Dead was very niche.
Yes.
And it was a sort of takeoff of Timothy Leary type transcendental books. And it's not for everyone, is it? And I remember triangulating some more information out of that a few years later when I came across it, but it didn't stick with me. But the one after this that stuck with me was Adrian Edmondson's How to Be a Complete Bastard.
By Leon Lapine, wasn't it? Yeah.
And that was colourful, I think. Again, thinking about coming to talk on this show, I thought, yeah, this was really the one I had. And then I started remembering others, actually. I had to be a complete bastard. The Spitting Image book was excellent for me. I should say now that I've stolen jokes from all of these books.
Have you?
I've learned joke shapes and templates, but I've actually stolen things and remixed them slightly. I've stolen things from the Spitting Image book, from the Bachelor Boys by the Score. In my head, if you've internalised it and not looked at it for 20 years, and it's part of your mulch now.
It is.
If I steal something and I'm really aware of it, I will take it out, as it were. But one line from Bachelor Boys made it in wholesale to Mr. Gunn, because I think I put it in as a little placeholder for myself and forgot to change it, right? And there is a couple of photo stories in Bachelor Boys, and the first one's called Who Farted? And so like they're all sitting around going, cool, Lord Lummy, cripes alive, who's dropped that revolting guff? And the rest of them go, not me! And then, that's the meatiest whopper that's ever been guffed. I can't breathe this, I'm a vegetarian. Right, and in book 8 of Mr. Gunn, they're riding through the little town of Lamont Bibber, and my character, Alan Taylor, the gingerbread man with electric muscles, there's all this fetid meat smell in the air. He goes, I can't breathe this, I'm a vegetarian! and I that was a note to me to get a joke
And it made it through.
It made it through. I don't think it's stealing if you accidentally stole it. It's like walking out of Sainsbury's with a can of peaches down your trousers.
It's not.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
The thing with these books as well is that back in the day when you might, again, we're talking about a million years ago, where you might not have owned the television or the video recorder was downstairs, you didn't have one in your bedroom, you couldn't watch The Young Ones again and again and again. But you could read the book again and again and again, and you could read it on your own, and it was an intimate thing. It's like giving someone one of those chord books for like 100 Beatles songs.
Right, because
you learn them, and then you can repeat them.
Yeah, the word is that this is really what I wanted to talk about for sure. It's studying it.
Yes.
You study these books, whether you're doing it in the toilet or in bed. Those are the two best places to do.
Or in the bath.
Or in the bath. Hey, hey readers. Oh, matey, blah, blah, blah.
That's still the rudest thing.
But it is the rudest thing. We should post a picture of it online or something.
It's measured by Jodrell Bank as the rudest thing that's ever happened.
Good gracious.
Jodrell Bank had to do it because of the rhyming slang. Yeah.
It's full of whimsy as well, this book, isn't it? I was surprised how whimsical it is, because that's not a word I would have associated with The Young Ones. Well, but it's things like the household hints bit with how to get... there's some great surrealism there. God. How to get bird shit out from under the carpet.
How to get a fish out of the television set. Yeah. You bend a pin, and it's just instructions on getting the fish out.
How to cope with there being a transistor radio in your cornflakes, you know?
but these are all the things that... as you guys know better than most, you know, a comedy writer has a whole bunch of stuff that they want to hit, and where better place to cram it into than at the corners.
You're filling this book up, and you mustn't be lazy filling it up. You want to fill it till it's brimming over.
But you accept that if you're writing a book like this, and you're Ben Elton and Rick Mayall and Lise Mayer or whatever, you go like, well, this is going to be about The Young Ones. That's going to be the touchstone for it. We keep coming back to it. It's The Young Ones. That's the world. We all know the world. We're never going to... But then you go, but I can play a few scales that I wouldn't normally.
Yeah.
And you go, well, there's a part of me that just wants to make a personal joke there, or just make a joke that's obscure enough to make me and six of my pals laugh.
Yes.
You get to put in your own
limitless
apocrypha.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it is limitless. There's a brilliant thing. We talked to the Gibbons brothers about this, who wrote the Alan Partridge memoirs.
Yeah.
And I said, well, how many drafts did that go? And they went, no, it literally, we just write to the page. We have a limited deadline, which is usually quite short. And the point is, every day, a page has got to be filled with whatever we put in it. We split it between us. We do half of it each. And the joke we said is that Alan would never do a second draft, so we don't do a second draft. But anything in his head, i.e. anything in our heads, is fair game for this. It doesn't have the same process as a television programme where you have to persuade someone to buy the prop to do this. There's very little production that would slow you putting every idea in the world. And we found this doing comedy Christmas books is everything is grist to the mill because everything fills this up.
Mm.
The biggest job is you must fill this bucket. What you can put anything you like in it, and at the end of the day, there has to be more in the bucket than there was at the beginning of the day, and that is the only measure of success as a writer of one of these books. So it leaves you completely liberated. So you get to see bits of the writer's brains you wouldn't do in a TV programme.
And I'll add one more rule, which is not a hard one to adhere to, which is that those apocrypha things that you put in, must not contradict the main world.
Yes.
So, like, if suddenly, you know, you discovered that Rick Mayall just really had to talk about his love of Mussolini, his actual and ironic love, which he didn't, that wasn't a thing, but you wouldn't know which of the young ones' brains it wouldn't fit into
there
the world.
There are rules.
The rules are easier to adhere to because it's you writing this, you know, you're the right person to write it spiritually because you get the humour, right? You know what I mean? And I mean, I don't mean you, Joel, and you, Jason. I mean, it is one who it's is authored. Writing this. Yeah. It's authored.
And the point is, the limits of it, why it's exciting, I think, reading any of these books that have been filled up by either the writing team on a show or a creator or a team of creators, is that anything out of their brains that they feel should go in this book will be right.
Exactly. It's an instinctive and vibey thing.
You couldn't explain it to someone. And we found that when we did Framley, I think, that was an incredibly dense thing of trying to fill 120, 200 pages of tiny, tiny print. And some friends of ours who are very good comedy writers said, can we contribute? And we kind of went, oh, that'd be great. That'd be really helpful. Within about 2 days, we realised that people sort of couldn't, because they'd get it 2% wrong.
Yeah.
And the only thing that was keeping this thing solid was that it was four of us writing it who knew it inside out and knew what didn't count.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've had this before with Mr. Gum, where I've had certain people wanting to collaborate with me and turn it into something before, you know, that never went anywhere. And I had a well-known comedian once wanting to write a Mr. Gum musical with me. And it was very hard to explain to him why it's funny that Mr. Gum slips in a gatto but not a trifle, for instance. Yeah. And you're like, and you can't explain it except to say, I know every internal pulley, it's a feel machine inside you, and you're so familiar with the material. You know, if somebody uses the comedy word eggs, the way I use the word eggs, and the way somebody else uses it in their comedy, it's a different sort of eggs, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's another reason why
they fit them in at different places.
But I think it's another reason why you can borrow the shapes and the patterns and the chord progressions you've learned from these books. You can use them yourself, and you will get them wrong. They'll be different. I did, for instance, that Mr. Gum joke that you borrowed, I wouldn't read that and go, that's from the young ones, because it sounds different on those instruments. But, same chords, different instruments.
But also, the other end of that is that if you're borrowing from anywhere, and everyone's borrowing from everywhere, that's a...
Yeah,
bit of an unspoken secret, isn't it? Or it should be. You know, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, or trying to clamber up their trousers. And but you're borrowing from places, but you have to internalise it. There's no... I say stealing, and I use that really loosely. It's not stealing. It's building on what you know and love. Yeah. You've taken someone's translation of reality, which in this case is three comedy writers making the Bachelor Boys book. They've processed reality into comedy. You unprocess it back, decide what it all means, decide what the currency of what they've told you is worth and how to redeploy it. You add everything else you know. And so long as you've reprocessed it and move it on, it will come out different.
Yeah.
Oh, there's so many rip-offs of Mr. Gum, but no one else knows. I'm conscious of them. And I like them. They're games to me. Like, they're typically low rent versions of other things found in children's books. I mean, I'll give you one easy one, but like lots of the Mr. Gum books end with everybody in town having a big feast because the peril is over and everyone in town has a big feast, and that's just taken wholesale from Asterix, which always ended like that. And then
the
concept is taken wholesale, and then I plug my characters in and do it my way. But I just thought that's a lovely way to end a story. That's very communal and warm.
Yeah, we have one. There's one that we relied on a few times in the Ladybird books, which is going somewhere and then landing vague. So I think we did something about a guy has bought the light from a lighthouse and has installed it in his shoe shop. He hopes this will make some important point or that thing. And then we realised that we took that from the meaning of LIF.
Yeah.
About that.
Hambledon.
The sound of a single-engined aircraft flying by while you're lying in a field in the middle of summer, which leaves you with a profound feeling of something or other.
Right, so it starts off really specific and then just goes...
And then just goes...
Yeah, like that. And you flop out. And the shape of that was always pleasing. So you went, well, I can use that in my comedy. And again, all these things, because you're right, you study these books, and you study these books probably more than you study... This comes up again and again on this show. People studied records because they had their headphones on. They'd listen to the Monty Python records and they'd learn them, or Derek and Clive or whatever. You'd study them and you'd study these books because they're private, they're intimate, and you have the time to carefully look at them.
Yes.
Which you don't do if something's going past in real time when you're watching one film at the cinema once, or an episode when it's on TV. You get more chance, I suppose, in the YouTube age to watch things again and again. But still, these don't happen in real time, so you get time to absorb them.
That's why I like kids finding things to read that are out of their out of what you would call at the appropriate level.
Yeah.
Or it's a slightly more elastic membrane for books than it is for film and TV, and it's exactly that, because if I read the word wank in the Bachelor Boys when I was 10 or so, which I did, I could think about it in front of me and meditate on it. I know that sounds wrong, but but no, I could work out what the currency of it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's all going to sound wrong, at length, at my leisure. But
on your own, you could sit in a private, comfortable time. Well, actually, I mean, to be honest...
Talk about Matey? It's the most famous page in the book.
Come on, let's talk about Matey.
Matey is a page in here which you remember.
You've
but
been
weirdly,
dying
I was about to say... We're comparing this
Matey.
to the Ur text, which is probably the first Python books and things. And there's a page about masturbation in the Python books.
Yeah.
That I remember being absolutely dynamite when I said... And it was because it was a word... and a phrase and an idea that wasn't in culture anywhere else, but it was definitely in comedy books. The word wank, the idea of masturbation, which now it seems weird that it wasn't. All other sorts of sexiness and sort of Kenny Everett and boobs and things and all that and nookie and all those sort of things were very much the currency of the times and were referred to in all comedy, in the Two Ronnies and things, stuff that was meant to be family. But oddly, this was a weird corner of stuff that was only in comedy books. And I remember it blowing my mind.
Yeah, I think you sort of get away with, you get away with kind of X certificate material, don't you, in a book better than you do on TV? Because on TV, it's just asking for trouble, but in a book, it's just asking for a laugh, isn't it?
Language has a bigger remit on the page; it has a bigger sphere. Yeah.
My dad went through my copy of Not 1982 or 3, the great big, fat almanac ones with two pages per day. And he took a Stanley knife to it and took out the dirty bits.
What?
Because I would have been about 11 or 12 when I was reading them, and he said, this is not suitable for you. And I said, there's days missing. Like, you could definitely spot a day is missing, because they label them in day order. Especially it was a calendar. And I went, well, June the 10th's gone. And he went, no, that wasn't for you. He'd gone through, and because he was aware that this was a dirtier place than watching it on TV.
Wow.
Censorship in my house.
I mean, it's like the M&M Safe for Radio version. There's like one word. Beep. I'm boop.
Melon farmer.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's either M&M or it ain't M&M, you know.
Let's have a go at reading this page. I'll try. Shall I try a Rick impression? I'll do a half of a Rick impression because I'm not an impressionist. Hello, mateys, says Rick of TV's famous Whoops, My Bottom's Farted. Aren't baths boring? But not anymore with new Matey foam bath. Remember that horrid moment when you've just started to wash your private bits and mum comes in to discuss your homework? Well, with a Matey foam bath, you can wash your willy as fast as you like and mum need never know.
Fast!
Matey helps you work up a lather in more ways than one. Perhaps they should change its name from Matey to Wanky. Right, kids? And in the middle of occupying the page is this picture of Rick Mail in a bath, which is overflowing, a filthy bath, which is overflowing with suds. And Rick Mail, who is a very beautiful man, has, again, one of the magic qualities he's had. He's made himself so ugly in this photograph.
Right.
He looks so unappealing. He looks so much like a teenage boy's idea of what a wanker is.
He looks like a fifth-rate version of Johnny Rotten crossed with one of those little naked mole rats or something.
He's like a goblin-faced... Yeah, like a gremlin or something.
Yeah, he doesn't, and it's not savoury, guys.
If there's anybody in the world you would less like to catch wanking and see what their wank face looks like, it's this guy with his rat tail hair.
It's actually the revolting bits, the big full page photo one. This is Rick's big soul. The Vivian one is Look at My Lovely Spot.
Yes.
Where he's talking about celebrating having spots because grown ups and Thatcher and the Genghis Khan don't have spots.
Yeah,
but Thatcher.
Yeah, it's brilliant, brilliant. Page, but those big revolting pages, they really hit you. And one of the things that really makes this book fantastic is that the cast have thrown themselves into it.
Yeah,
we've had. I remember the first experience we ever, the first job we ever did professionally for money as a pair of us in comedy was writing a tie-in book for Russ Abbott or for BBC years ago when we were kids. And we did it for a flat fee, for a bit of money on the side. And we said, because we'd read these books before, we said, we'll get Russ and he'll dress up as Basil and Barnes, and he'll dress up as the Mountain, he'll dress up as Cooperman. And they went, no, he won't. He won't do that. He won't do that. And it was a time when stars wouldn't do that. They would. It was extra money. And the story we were told by, I think, Peter Vincent, who was putting the book together, he said he'd done a two Ronnie's joke book. And he'd written the whole thing, and it was going to be the most of the money was going to the Rons, and he'd written the whole thing on a flat fee. And he said, can I have some photographs? And they went, no, absolutely not. And he brought his own camera to a writing meeting and just snapped 10 photos of them against a wall, and that was the illustrations of the book. And he said, it's impossible to get stars to join in. They don't want to join in the cash-in stuff when they reach a certain size. But these guys have thrown themselves in 100%, and it really makes the book work because it's suddenly got their... It feels like it's seamlessly part of the television programme rather than a bolt-on.
Yeah.
And it's faces like that. It's you're getting full Rick Mayall. It's amazing.
Also, none of it, I think I'm right in saying, none of it is TV material rewritten for the book.
No.
Which is the other thing that can happen with these ones.
No, this is all brand new overflow. Fresh filth, yeah.
It's got some proper jokes now. I love the interview with David Bowie that's clearly taking place at Wembley Stadium with him just singing in the background and Neil not getting any straight answers out of it.
Brilliant show.
Proper joke.
And there's a photo of the stadium crowd at Wembley. You know, it's a long-range photo and there's just an arrow to a blob on the page, which is already low res, and it just says Neil, and then there's another arrow to the stage, Bowie. I mean, that taught me a lot. It's funny.
Yeah.
And then I was just thinking about this kind of language thing again, though, right? These days, when you can put fuck and cunt and shit and whatever you want on TV, it's all being devalued. So so it's harder to see the split in some ways between what's on TV filth-wise and sort of, but how do you push it further when you go into a comedy book? I'd still suggest that it's not just the language, it's the kind of depth of the ideas. Like, even though it's very silly political point making, like Ben Elton's obsession with the Russian Revolution.
Trotsky.
Trotsky comes up all the time in this book. Yeah. Trotsky vies for Thatcher, vies with Thatcher for a sort of word count.
The feeling of like a slightly adolescent understanding of politics and trying to sound grown up by putting politics. When Rick's got his play that he's written, and the climax of the play, the last line of the play is "Look out, everybody! Nuclear war end." And that's a really good understanding of someone not grasping a subject but wanting to put it in because they need to be seen to do it.
Right.
It's reaching for language that's beyond you.
But it also, But also, apart from Rick being a pathetic, naive sort of wannabe, who's constantly exposing his own sort of lack of real cred, which is a brilliant character, just the sheer weight of references to what is, you know, fairly obscure Marxist-Leninist stuff. But, you know, Ben Elton made it not obscure by bringing that into comedy. Yeah. But the sheer weight of that, and, you know, if you hear Trotsky enough, you start to go in your 10, who was Trotsky, right?
Yeah.
Who was
yeah.
Stalin? And then there'll be things that are a little further. You know, the fact they had Alexei Sale on, the young one, sort of doing the revolutionary biscuits of Italy rise up out of the box. You have nothing to do with the wafers. Yum, 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 yum. No, I've never seen that one, but... all of this is code. All of this is clues. You go, look, I've just opened it at random, and it's the pages Leon Trotsky's Just Fancy That.
Hi, Mike. It's going well, isn't it?
They're constantly reaching for words, even within this book where you could be rude. They're looking for new ways of doing language. So it has got those lovely sort of poopy plop bottom pants stuff in there. That's really good. And one of my favourite things I'd forgotten from it, I read it this morning and laughed, is the game, the cheesy feet game, where the command to take your socks off is "cheese it, you rebels." "Cheese it, you rebels" is one of the best combinations of words ever written. And again, they could have sworn there. And they don't. They go for something deliberately slightly childish, but also a lovely combination of words.
It's got such gusto. it really has that. "Jeez, it, you rebels." That's absolute right there. I mean, I haven't read this word for word to come and talk today because I like to have it, hold it in my head.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, because it's in me. But "Jeez, it, you rebels," that is... There's a direct line from "Cheese at You Rebels" to how I write for Mr. Gum.
Yeah, that was the first thing I thought was that I can hear you in your head when you read that. And I read that as a kid, and I found that one of the funniest things. I probably said it again and again to my brothers. It became a thing. We said, I loved it, And it meant that when I want to reach for something now that gets that reaction out of someone else, that's in my DNA. Some of this is just about sticking words together that shouldn't go together and having them in character. It's for a book that is palpably and demonstrably someone filling as many pages as they can, as fast as they can. What you've got there is basically automatic writing. You're saying to the people who invented the Young Ones on television, just quick, everyone, as fast as you can, all your thoughts. And weirdly, that's when you get the essence of people. This is purer and more essentially the silliness that gave you that series than probably the series is, because it's not diluted with rehearsals or this having to persuade Paul Jackson it's a good idea.
Or you can't fit it all into 22 minutes. Well, BBC, you can't fit it into half an hour.
Yeah.
You know.
35 minutes here once.
Was it 35?
Because it had music in the middle.
I'll take it back. You can fit it into 35 minutes, but they didn't. No, you can't. You can't fit in every last thought. You can't. You can't fit it into anything. But you can put a hell of a lot of it. The overspill and the routines that didn't go anywhere or weren't good as a back and forth amongst the characters, or the ideas that from the cutting room floor that you then pick up and, like you say, run with in an inspired way towards the finish line to get them in there.
Ah, John!
I've been starstruck twice in my life, right? Once was when I saw Jacqueline Wilson at Waterloo Station and I ran over and terrified her by fanboying all over.
Really?
And the other
Jacqueline Wilson?
Yeah.
Not Jackie Wilson. There's no? Jacqueline Wilson.
Jacqueline Wilson, the
author. Why are you a fanboy for Jacqueline Wilson?
Because my kids have read loads of her books and I read them to them when they were younger and they're so beautifully written.
As a children's author, you get to see stuff, Jason. I have seen Jacqueline Wilson riding a camel in the desert. Oh, it's true. And
what?
And belly dancing.
This is like the end of Blade
Runner. Right.
Musical sting, please. As a children's author, you get to see stuff, Jason. I have seen Jacqueline Wilson riding a camel in the desert. Oh, it's true. And belly dancing.
The other time I was starstruck was a few years ago. We were at the thing at the BBC. And I was sitting a row behind Lisa Mayer, and I couldn't bring myself to speak to her because I was so starstruck.
I wouldn't know what Lisa Mayer looks like to this day, and I didn't even hear the pronoun there because I just didn't hear it. I still don't know if Lisa Mayer is a man or a woman. I think she's a woman.
She is a woman.
I found out this morning, this is a good fact for you. Do you know why Vivian's name is spelt Vivian? V-Y-V-A.
I do not.
It is Lisa Mayer's road in Bristol was Vivian Road.
No!
Named after the Cornish landowners, the Vivian family, who gave us Rupert Everett is a descendant.
What?
There's my fact tornado for you. Vivian Road, you can find it. It's in Clifton in Bristol. She was just obviously looked out the window and went, Vivian, that's a good name.
Everyone's everyone's father!
Music!
We should end with some reading, shouldn't we? Should we just read some favourite bits out?
Can we read some favourite bits, yeah?
Yeah, should we do that? Andy, could you please read Rick's Teen Anguish poem, please?
Yeah. I like the intro as well, though. The first way to beat the blues is to write a poem. I wrote this one and it's brilliant. And it helped me a lot. So that's my advice to you. If you're feeling depressed, read my poem. That's a great gag, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rick's Teen Anguish poem. Oh, God. Why am I so much more sensitive than everybody else? Why do I feel things so much more acutely than them and understand so much more? I bet I'm the first person who ever felt as rotten as this. Could it be that I'm going to grow up to be a great poet and thinker and all those other wankers in my class are going to have to work in factories or go on the dole? Yes, I think it could.
That's just reminded me that the other great icon of exactly this era was Adrian Mole. And I remember reading Adrian Mole at the same time as this.
Yes.
And Rick and Adrian Mole being the two people who basically showed me how to get through adolescence. And obviously, that's a joke about how to get through adolescence. But I think they were both very, very useful to understand that feeling of why? Why me? Why am I so sensitive? They were really empathetic depictions of that experience of adolescence. And I don't know how I'd have got through without the pair of them. They were absolutely brilliant. And it's a stupid bum joke wanky book.
They're not even real, are they? That's good, isn't it?
They're fantastic.
Not even real. They're just ideas.
Made up by
squiggles
people.
On pages and that.
Someone made that happen. But I think there is a valuable thing in the Young Ones, especially because you read it and experienced it when you were slightly younger, that it did help get you through by making it. The worst thing about being a teenager is taking yourself very seriously and saying that it's silly and funny and you might end up as a hippie. It's great. It's really useful.
To sort of not to disparage the quite deep points you made there. One of my favourite bits is when there's a photo of Neil and Vivian has written on it in marker, "Hello, I am a turd." That didn't teach me anything except funny.
It's just brilliant. It's such a big pen.
And it's the perfect photo. Can we put photos up online? Can you do that these days? But that is an example of absolute perfect no punctuation, just completely run on. "Hello, I am a turd." It's just so without nuance. It's so brutal.
It's a hammer.
Give me it.
No one ever talks about Mike, do they?
I really like Mike as a character. I think one of the easiest things in the world to say is that Mike's rubbish. And I think one of my favourite lines in the whole of the Young Ones is, "Shut up, Rick, no one's on fire."
Well, he's an interesting one because, like, you know, I think it was who wrote that big Radio 4 guide to comedy, Mark Lewisham or something?
Yeah, Mark Lewisham, yeah.
And I think he makes the point that, you know, they thought they were making an anti-sitcom with the Young Ones, but if you look at it, Mike and Neil are the mum and dad, or the dad and mum. Yeah. And Rick and Vivian are the kids, and that's a useful thing.
And you can't do it without the dad. A lot of things, if you look at it as well, he's the least fun one, but none of the plots happen without him. He drives things on. Mm. And they're all given things to do by there being a Mike there. And I think Chris Ryan's great in it as well. He's exactly right. He balances them up.
I agree. I just think he's hard to talk about because you feel like he's the Ringo or you're defending
him. Yeah, yeah.
I always like his relationship with Viv, though.
Yes.
They always had a little alliance going on. And I think Viv, they used to, you know, Viv scored some money off Rick or something, he'd literally tear it in half and give half to Mike.
Half to you, Mike.
Idiots, yeah. Thank you, Viv.
This is a book about you are putting into amber, you're preserving comic voices, and it's just done in prose. It requires nothing else.
Right, Mr. Gum has a lot of Vivian, the way I do him on audio and the way that Steve First, in fact, will be doing him on stage. Oh, it's not going to be Vivian, but it's dialed in.
Yeah, because
shut up, Billy.
But you know how to do that because, again, this book has shown you can encode performances of this size, huge live
characters.
Stage performances, can be turned into little words on a page.
Very often when you are writing, though, do you find this? I do, definitely. I've got a voice in my head that I can hear of that character, even though this thing doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, there are tones and colours in this. In a black and white textbook, they've managed to somehow encode the whole of the feel of this very, very vibrant, musical, loud, slapstick show.
Yeah.
And I think it is a really good achievement because it's a black and white, mainly textbook.
Yeah.
But we all studied it growing up and it's all gone into our DNA. And I think possibly, in a way, as much, more than the TV show. It's really important.
For me, it has. For me, it absolutely has. The one thing that this book doesn't do that was my cross to bear is that it doesn't have to sustain one narrative.
No.
So actually what it taught me was how lots and lots of shapes for routines, lots of templates, lots of games to play and then develop my own from. But it doesn't tell you how to sustain some semblance of stakes and storyline because they always have a get out. They can always pop the bubble and then you turn over the page and it's cookery, whereas before it was about, you know, flower arranging.
But I suppose that's another one of the reasons why these books are so delightful is because they don't have to do that. They only have one job, which is to put all the jokes in the world in.
They are basically a
super course, a comedy course.
It's not a failing at all. What it gave me was a whole sort of toolbox to then dial into a slightly different form, which was one narrative.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That is what a thing to have achieved in the most unlikely way. And I'm so glad, because you suggested this and I thought this is a brilliant idea to talk about this as a crash course in comedy writing. And it's been brilliant to look at it and just, it's blown my mind how much was in this that I'd completely forgotten. So it's thank you, Andy. What a wonderful thing to bring in. Cheers.
Thank you so much, guys.
Andy.
Oh, you know, you guys.